Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The auto industry is promising that high-tech driving will deliver us from crashes, congestion, and carbon emissions. Today, the panacea is autonomous vehicles, but this vision is the latest in a long history of illusory futuramas that the auto industry has invented to get more people to drive cars. Today, we talk with Peter Norton, whose new book, Autonorama, explores how promoting these high-tech solutions distracts us from investing in the affordable, inclusive, healthful, and sustainable transportation technologies that we already have. Peter, welcome to Locus Focus.
It's great to be here, Barbara.
Well, I've had a lot of conversations with friends about the inevitability of autonomous vehicles, and it has disturbed me quite a bit because I've had this unnerving feeling ever since I started hearing about driverless cars that I don't want to be in one and I don't want to be around one. So your book appealed to me because it looked like it was a very skeptical examination of this whole phenomenon. So I want to know if you share my skepticism that autonomous vehicles, there's maybe a little something wrong with the picture.
Yes, very much. I mean, they might be useful for certain things, but they can't be what they're being promised for us.
Well, what's interesting in your book is you show how the great promises that are being made about autonomous vehicles now are nothing new. So there's a long history of the automobile industry making great promises. So let's go back to the beginning and sort of trace how it is that the automobile industry has basically stayed in business by making all these glowing promises about the future.
Well, a long time ago, General Motors in particular, and we're going back to the 1920s now, began to realize that if it just sold the car as a useful special purpose transport tool, which is what it originally was, then they weren't going to have as big a market as they would like. In other words, farmers would get a car to get the crop to market, a grocery store would get a car to deliver the groceries to a customer, but they really wanted a much bigger market than that could be. And so they started to sell not just cars, but driving. Driving as the modern, all-purpose way to get around. And that was a way to redefine the car from a useful tool into an all-purpose necessity. And General Motors really introduced that idea in the 30s. And we've really been living with that sales pitch ever since.
Well, I'm thinking about all those movies that were made in the 30s, which I'm particularly thinking of some Humphrey Bogart movies where cars played a really big role. I'm wondering if Hollywood had anything to do with the romanticization of the automobile, along with the romanticization of the cigarette.
Oh, yes. So both the cigarette and the car were sort of marketed through film, sometimes deliberately with the cooperation of the companies involved. There's a great American road story that's told in countless forms, especially in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s. And in those stories, the car is a character as much as the human beings are. And they're also a source of sort of value for the characters involved, particularly the macho men. The car is a sort of extension of their machismo, and so yeah, that's a part of our car culture in this country, and you could see that cultural associations being developed from Hollywood as much as from Detroit.
I'd like to look at how it happened that people started to feel like they really needed a car to get around. Because particularly if you lived in a city back in those days, it seemed like there was really ample public transportation, probably better than there is now.
Definitely, Barbara. The public transportation in even a sort of small, nowheresville kind of city was remarkably good for most of America, with electric railways serving the downtown and even the suburbs, and often connecting you to the next city as well. And the express train service connecting you to larger cities far away. So yes, the public transport was generally quite good. The walkability was quite good too, because unlike today, the grocery store could open up next door to the apartment building or the house. So you could walk to meet your needs. The children could typically walk to school. Daily needs and errands could be met on foot, on a bicycle, or with a bus or a streetcar, depending on when we're talking about. And those facts really did limit the market for cars, especially in cities. And in fact, when in the early 20s, people were not buying cars, especially in cities, the uptake was much slower in cities. The car makers in Detroit noticed that, and they had meetings about it. And we know what they said because they kept good records. In the meetings, they said things like, you know what, we're not selling cars to people who live in cities, and we need to figure out a way to change that. And one of the ways in which they set out to change it was to try to deliberately redefine the car as something everybody needs and as a way to get to work and as a way to meet daily needs. Or, you know, for a typical city person who owned a car at all 100 years ago, it was a weekend sort of leisure tool. It was often called a pleasure car. And they worked very hard to redefine it as something you have to have. And at the same time, they set about to redesign cities in such a way that that would be true, that you really would have to have it or you were going to be stuck.
Well, I grew up in a small city in New England, and it didn't have very good mass transit, and I couldn't wait to get a car. And actually, I didn't ever get my own car while I was living at home, but I did get my mother's car. And it seemed like once I got the car, we had all this freedom. And not only could we just go around our town, but we could drive out to Cambridge, which was 40 miles away, and hang out where it was really cool. But then I moved to New York to go to college, and the last thing you wanted was a car. And in fact, the few times since then that I've been in New York with a car, all I wanted to do was ditch the car, which is what I usually did. So I wonder how that translates to the older cities like New York and Philadelphia and Boston, for that matter, where having a car is more of a hindrance than a convenience.
Well, in New York, it's still very much that way. For other cities, including big cities like Boston and Philadelphia and Chicago, if they were old pre-automotive cities, it is really astonishing the extent to which the authorities, the experts, the planners, the highway departments made sure that people would still be able to drive right through Boston, right through Philadelphia, right through Chicago. You know, the center of Boston was really ripped out to make room for the central artery, which was a big highway put right through the middle of the city, devastating the city. And it was recognized as a catastrophic mistake, and such a mistake that at a cost of billions of dollars, it's now all been buried and the surface has been converted into parks and walkable spaces. And elsewhere in America now, the United States Department of Transportation is saying it's time to remove some of these major, very destructive and expensive highway projects that cut right through cities. So New York is different in the sense that it was never invaded quite as much by these big projects. There were some invasive projects there too. But even the pre-automotive cities where getting around by car never really made sense, the effort to make those cities into drivable cities and cities where you could find a parking place too were really extraordinary.
Well, I find it interesting you're describing, I guess it was the New York World's Fair in the 1930s, where GM had this exhibit, which was basically showing the city in which everything about the city had to do with the car. I forget the phrase that you used for it, because it really says so much about the difference of that vision and the vision of a city like New York, even still today, where New York's a place where the highway fell down. Like, remember when the West Side Highway fell down many numbers of years ago, and they never rebuilt it. Now instead they have this wonderful walking trail. That's where the highway was. But the vision of GM in the 30s, what would that city be like?
Well, the GM vision that General Motors presented to fairgoers at the New York World's Fair of 1939 and 40 in New York City was a vision of the city of 20 years later, which meant the city of 1960. And fairgoers saw a gigantic model of this city and viewed it as if they were looking through an airplane window down below at this city of the future. And in that version of the future, people could drive anywhere at any time without delay and park for free when they got there. And that's actually not hard to pull off in a model, because you can make the model however you want to make it. It turned out to be much harder to make it in reality. And so if you look, if you compare, say, pictures of the city of 1960 in that model, which was called Futurama, a fusion of future and diorama, if you take take those photographs of that model and you put them side by side with the real city of 1960, there's some similarities because both have some big highways, but there's big differences too, because the real city of 1960 has had its guts ripped out to make room for parking all of those cars. And typical aerial photograph of a city in the 60s shows lots of areas where the buildings have been ripped out and surface parking has really taken over. So this much of the city turns into a car storage facility instead of a real city.
I was listening to a story on the radio the other day about the neighborhood of Treme in New Orleans, and this woman was talking about what a vital neighborhood it was until they put this freeway through it, which happens to be the oldest black neighborhood in the United States. So let's talk a little bit about where these freeways went and how they were designed, in fact, to do a certain kind of social engineering.
Most definitely. So, in New Orleans, as in, I would say most, but what I really have to say is practically all American cities, these highway projects went overwhelmingly, not exclusively, but overwhelmingly through the black communities, the communities of color, throughout the U.S. And, you know, sometimes people will say, well, that was just dollars and cents. They were putting it where, you know, it was least expensive to put the road, which is not a totally false reply. But in America, it's not an accident that the people with the least money have also been the people who are black and brown. And it's also more than that, too, because of a couple of factors. One is the political influence of residents had a lot to do with where these roads went. And so a relatively affluent middle class or upper class white community could get the political influence they needed to divert the highway around their community, while communities of color almost never could pull that off. Another factor is that the planners came up with a lot of euphemisms which they used to sort of pretend that they were engaging in a benevolent, progressive social exercise. For example, they would often say that these highway projects were also exercises in slum clearance or removing blight, removing substandard housing. And so what they were claiming, and it was a very weak, far-fetched claim, but it was a very persistent claim, is that they were doing these communities a favor by tearing down what they called substandard housing, what other people would call affordable housing. It was also, incidentally, often the housing that was the only housing available because residential segregation was absolutely pervasive, and landlords took advantage of their monopoly market to not maintain the buildings they rented to black and brown people. And then they became blighted, and then that blight became the excuse for routing the expressway through there. Sometimes the initial plan was to route the expressway through white communities, but very often those white communities had the political influence they needed to stop those projects and get them redirected through black communities.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Peter Norton, whose new book, Autonorama, The Illusory Promise of High-Tech Driving, explores how the illusion of these high-tech solutions distracts us from investing in the affordable, inclusive, healthful, and sustainable transportation technologies that we already have. I think that Portland is one of the few places I've lived in where they actually stopped a lot of freeways. Or some freeways. And we're having a current freeway battle because there's been this ongoing debate for, I don't know, a couple decades now about putting a new bridge over the Columbia River that separates Washington and Oregon. And its last iteration was called the Columbia River Crossing. Now they have some new name for it, but it's basically the same, possibly 12-lane freeway bridge that will, of course, expand the freeway in Portland through black and brown neighborhoods. But interestingly, when I moved to Portland, they were planning on putting a freeway through in the southeast part of Portland, which is pretty much, in those days and still is pretty much a white neighborhood. And it was called the Mount Hood Freeway, and it was going to just plow through this neighborhood, which actually I lived in for a number of years, and a lot of upset about it. And we had a mayor at the time, Neil Goldschmidt, and he stopped the freeway in the last moments. And then shortly after that, he became Jimmy Carter's Secretary of Transportation. And he was a model for public transit. He actually was one of the movers of how we got our first light rail built in Portland. Most places that I've spent time in, particularly in the West Coast, I think of Oakland or I think of L.A., where you go several blocks and there's a freeway. And the whole city seems to be these quadrants of freeways. And it, for one thing, it makes it really hard to find your way around the city because each one of these intersections of the freeway looks the same. And I wonder if we can talk about that kind of structure and how different that is from the Futurama vision of the city where you could drive everywhere.
Well, the Futurama vision was never a realistic vision, and it wasn't really feasible simply because, one of the things that defines a city is it has to be at least somewhat dense in terms of the number of people who live in each square mile. While moving people by car requires the opposite of density. And so the more you try to accommodate cars in cities, the more you have to destroy them and de-densify them and spread people out. It also tends to lead to cities that are lacking in distinctness, like you said, because Main streets can be diverse and variable. The highways depend on standardization. You have to have standard interchanges, standard on-ramps, exit ramps, overpasses, and so on. And then the whatever businesses you site along them tend to be large chain stores because nobody wants to pull off the highway for a little sandwich shop. So this is, something that is sort of antagonistic to cities as they have typically been understood as places where you can accommodate a lot of small businesses and where you have a mix of people going around in different ways. The sort of geography you're describing for Los Angeles is an attempt to make that Futurama vision come true. But another reason why it can't really come true is that cities also depend on a lot of people not getting around by car, because if literally everybody did, it would be permanent gridlock everywhere. And there's plenty of people, even in Los Angeles, who can't afford to have their own car. And Los Angeles depends on the hard work of those people to make sure that the office buildings are cleaned, the hotels are staffed, and the service industries are running, and therefore the city really depends on having a large carless population to work.
Well, actually, Los Angeles has a subway now. I wonder what that says about that vision of this city that's completely car-driven and car-oriented, when even Los Angeles, which is probably the closest we have to a city of that vision, is going in the direction of public transit.
That's right. Even big car-dependent cities like Los Angeles, like Houston, have had to recognize, and they have, that as long as their only solution to every traffic problem was to add lanes, add exit ramps, add overpasses, and so on, that actually all they were doing was sort of trying to keep up on a treadmill of ever-growing demands for more capacity. Because, when you try to relieve traffic congestion by adding road capacity, then you're encouraging destinations to open up further and further apart from each other, which means there's more and more driving. And that means that, in fact, you can't really keep up with the ever-growing traffic demand. And if you really want to relieve congestion, you have to give people choices besides driving. And that's the one thing that's been proved to work. And even Los Angeles has recognized that to some degree, and they had to actually reopen some of the rights of way they had cleared for a subway project that went back to the 1930s, but that was never fully pursued, to make the metro they have there now although that metro is still only a tiny fraction of what that city really needs.
I'm actually thinking of Calgary, where they have a light rail. And I was really excited. I was in Calgary a few years ago, and I hadn't been there since 1970. And there was no light rail or even thought of it back in those days. But I've discovered that the light rail went 10 blocks. And
yeah, light rail has a lot of critics, tends to be very expensive and have limited service. And that's partly because it's very hard to have a very small light rail system that's useful. But when you have an extensive network that where people can go to the station and know that another tram is coming, another streetcar is coming sometime in the next 15 minutes, well, then suddenly it turns out to be a wonderful thing to have. So it's not that light rail is good or bad. It's that for light rail to be good, people have to know that the next train, the next streetcar is coming fairly soon. They won't have to wait an hour for it. And when it does come, it can take them somewhere they need to go. And any light rail system that's just a few miles long probably can't do that.
It's been interesting to watch the Portland light rail system grow since the 80s when it first started running. And now it's pretty extensive. It's actually a light rail that's not that far from my house. It's about a half mile further than I wish it were, but they can walk there. And it's also such a more pleasant way to go into town than either by certainly more pleasant than driving or taking the bus. And Portland's light rail system has been touted all over, but I wonder how the forces that oppose that and what the arguments are for why you wouldn't want to invest in a light rail.
Well, it's interesting. We have a long history in this country of defining any project in which taxpayer money is spent on roads for cars as an investment, and any project where the same taxpayer money is spent on public transportation as a subsidy or funding, but not an investment. So it's the same money, and it's committed for transportation in the same in both cases, and yet we tend to define the one as an investment and the other as a kind of public charity almost, and that definition has a troubling history, where for example, our state transportation departments, for decades, all of them were called the State Highway Department. And in the 70s, they sort of took the initial step of redefining themselves, of renaming themselves, but they still remain essentially highway departments. And the critics of light rail are correct that light rail is very expensive, and when you have a small system, it doesn't look like a good use of the money. But you can't have a large system without starting off as a small system, and it offers some wonderful benefits. Like you said, when you take the streetcar or the light rail system or the tram or whatever it's called in your town, you can sit down and do some work, open your laptop, get on your phone, read a book. The people selling us autonomous vehicles to now are trying to sell them on that basis. But the difference is, it is fantastically cheaper to move a person in a streetcar when there's, say, 20, 30, 40 other people on it, than to move people one or two or three at a time in an autonomous vehicle. And there's another huge difference, too, and that's, supplying the batteries for electric autonomous vehicles will be incredibly difficult and involve getting minerals that come from very disturbing sources, like the cobalt from the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where child labor under hazardous conditions that's exploitively underpaid supplies the minerals, while with the electric streetcar, it doesn't need a battery because it draws its power from lines overhead or underneath. It might have a small battery in case of an interruption in the power supply, but it doesn't need a large battery. So that's a huge payoff given the fact that we need an electrified transport future.
I want to add that the lithium for those batteries also comes from very challenging places, one of them being the Oregon-Nevada border on Paiute tribal land, or adjacent to the land, and actually where they want to do the mining is a sacred spot for the tribe. So I think that's another thing we could look at about how the resource extraction that's going to feed and serve this autonomous vehicle future, the Tanorama, that's actually coming at the expense of a lot of indigenous people.
Oh, yeah. And that's true worldwide. So right now, the lithium is mostly coming from Chile, and there are indigenous people in the deserts of northern Chile who already are finding it harder to get the water that they need because the water is already scarce to start with, and getting the lithium out of Chile takes a lot of water as well. And lithium, cobalt, nickel, these metals that the batteries need are all in short supply. And if we try to have, say, 1 billion or 2 billion electric vehicles in the world, it's very hard to see how that can happen. And if it can happen, it would have to happen at the cost of the well-being of indigenous peoples and of hardworking laborers in the countries that mine these metals, and that incidentally don't benefit from electrification, because the cobalt miners in Congo are not going to be driving electric vehicles.
You talked about the Futurama 1, but in your book you actually talk about 4 different Futuramas. So let's talk about Futurama number 2.
Yeah, so, I mean, the general background for that is that General Motors' visions, and other companies' visions too, wasn't just General Motors, of these car-driving futures couldn't really work. And so when they failed, they would have to be repackaged and resold and presented to us in a new way again. So when Futurama 1 was presented in 1939 and 1940, it showed us the city of 1960. The real city of 1960 was a big disappointment by comparison to that. Social critics, like especially Jane Jacobs, pointed that out in her bestseller from 1961 called The Death and Life of Great American Cities. And so now, you know, one response to that might have been, well, it turns out we shouldn't be pursuing this drive everywhere city that we've been trying for. Let's stop. But if you're General Motors, you don't want to take that path. Same with Ford Motor Company, by the way. They instead came up with a new vision of the future. At the World's Fair in New York in 1964, General Motors had another exhibit that they called Futurama 2. And again, it showed us the city of 20 years into the future. They were less precise about the timing. And now they said, okay, it couldn't work the first time, but we have this amazing new technology called transistors. And we'll equip all our cars and highways with these transistors. And they are going to somehow make it possible for car dependency to work in cities. And so they showed visions of the city of the future that where electronics, it was the electronic age, was going to make this work. And there were a lot of projects that promised that we would be in driverless cars within a few years. None of them came anywhere close to happening. They just were limited to some experimental test tracks. And so Futurama 2 ended up being a failure as well.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Peter Norton, whose new book, Autonorama, The Illusory Promise of High-Tech Driving, explores how the illusion of these high-tech solutions distracts us from investing in the affordable, inclusive, healthful, and sustainable transportation technologies that we already have. Well, to move on to Futurama 3, there, the highways got involved more, right? It was not just the cars. It was more like the highways at this point that were going to be turned into this high-tech phenomenon.
That's exactly right. So it was pretty clear that these efforts to make cars operate themselves were a big disappointment in that time. So the people wanting to sell us car-dependent cities didn't give up. Instead, they said, well, look, well, we're going to make the roads smart instead of the cars. The roads will be high-tech roads. They called them smart highways. Some of your audience will remember that in the Gulf War, I'm talking about 1990 and 91, the TV news was full of video footage showing so-called smart bombs destroying targets in Iraq. And that term, smart bomb, then got extended to so-called smart other things, including smart highways. And some of the same people who made and sold the smart bombs were very anxious that the Cold War was ending. They were going to lose their big federal government customer. And they began making pitches, including making advertisements that said, we're going to take our high-tech weapons technology and we are going to recommit it to relieving traffic congestion. So we'll stop fighting wars and start fighting traffic congestion instead. And so the way they said this was going to work, and this was technology companies, military contractors, car makers, road builders, and others, they got together and they said, we are going to equip highways with the technology necessary such that when you get on the road, the technology will take over and drive your car for you. And they said this was going to prevent crashes, especially they said this would eliminate traffic congestion. They never had a satisfactory explanation for why it would relieve traffic congestion because, of course, if you use technology to sort of space all the cars more closely together while they're going fast, that doesn't solve any problems when people try to get off the road and go into the city. You just have even more cars trying to fit into the city. And people saw that defect right away. But that didn't stop the people selling the smart highways from requesting and getting billions of federal money to try to make this happen. Now, I should say they never called this dream Futurama 3. But I thought that was a fitting name for it. So when I wrote the book, I called this 1990s smart highway boondoggle, which is what it really was. It was a taxpayer-funded failure costing tens of billions of dollars. I decided a good name for it would be Futurama 3 because like in Futurama 1 and Futurama 2, both of which really were named Futurama, they were selling the same vision, the vision of a crash-free, congestion-free, car-dependent future that can't happen.
Well, it seems that maybe one outgrowth of that were these signs that we have, these electronic signs that are on freeways everywhere telling you how long it's going to take you to get to this place or that place, or telling you this congestion ahead or suggested speeds or kind of maybe like you better slow down or you're going to have a crash. Is that something that came out of the whole technological development for the smart highways?
Yes, so the insiders called these things intelligent transportation systems, by which they just meant really sort of computerized systems. And yes, they really could, with a lot of hardware and software, give people those variable message signs that say something like next exit 12 minutes or something like this, or congestion ahead. The insiders call those dynamic message signs. That achievement took tens of billions of dollars. This also sort of accelerated the date by which we got GPS systems on cars. GPS is another big government project. It came out of the military. And then it was opened up for civilian use in the 90s. And so we got onboard navigation systems from these intelligent transportation systems people. Now, but they said we were going to get far more for that. They said you're going to get onto the highway and then you'll take your hands off the steering wheel and read your newspaper because the car will be driving itself. This was the promise they made. They never came anywhere close to getting it, but they did talk Congress into giving them a lot of money to make it happen or to try to make it happen. They did have one sort of demonstration project where for a few days in the summer of 1997, a stretch of an interstate highway outside of San Diego was used as a test bed for these things, and people on the test vehicles could take their hands off the steering wheel. But, in the end, that turned out not to be at all useful and a complete dead end and an extremely expensive dead end as well.
I'm just wondering, what is this obsession with driverless cars? Is there a belief that somewhere in some ideal world, this is better than having us human beings drive?
It's I'm as baffled by that as you are. I mean, they have some off-the-shelf answers to give you if you ask them that question, but the answers don't stand up. So the first answer you're going to get, if you ask the people who sell these things, Why are you obsessed with having a driverless car? They'll say, well, we have a horrible situation where something on the order of 37 or 38,000 Americans are killed every year on roads. And most of those deaths are attributable ultimately to human failure. And so if we take the human being out of the equation, then we will eliminate all those crashes. Now, it doesn't take a genius to figure out that there's a big gap in that logic. Namely, the robot cars will only drive better than the humans if the robots have fewer failures than the humans. And they don't. Now, there's a lot of things the robots don't do that humans do, including things like the robots don't drink, the robots don't drive intoxicated, they don't get distracted, they don't drive fatigued, they don't drive with impatience, and so on. And so all those things are in the robot's favor. And the people selling the robotic driving systems are very quick to point those out. But what they don't point out is that the robotic systems are full of failures that humans don't make. Humans are much better at sort of predicting what the vehicles around them are going to do next, or at merging in traffic, or at reading the body language of a pedestrian. And these are things that are fantastically hard for the machines to do. Yes, they're improving at it, but they're getting nowhere close. And another sort of obfuscation you'll constantly hear is that, you know, given the unlimited technology at an unlimited price, you can get some quite impressive things out of the technology. But the fact of the matter is we need affordable transportation. We don't need vehicles that no one can afford to ride in because they have to be so thoroughly equipped with hardware and software to make them work.
Well, there's been some rather notorious examples of deaths due to autonomous vehicles. And I know there's been passenger deaths. There's also been driver deaths. So why don't we run down some of those? And I do believe that Tesla was involved with at least some of those deaths, if not all of them.
So yeah, Tesla has been involved in deaths that happened particularly because the vehicle operator, the driver, was overconfident about what the technology could do. So Tesla has this feature that they call autopilot, which is a very controversial name to give this feature because all it does is keep the vehicle in the lane on the highway. It does not do all the driving for you and it can't handle all situations. But, you know, if you're going to buy one of these vehicles and you love the technology, then you're very likely to sort of see what it can do, and it will lull you very quickly into a sense of overconfidence because it is, frankly, quite impressive. And so on YouTube, it's very easy to find videos of people who have engaged their vehicle's autopilot and are then, you know, enjoying games, sitting in the back seat, sleeping. Those are quite common. And in a couple of the fatalities that have happened, it was clear that the driver vastly overestimated what the technology can do. There was a notorious case in Florida where apparently the man driving the car was watching a movie, and then the vehicle couldn't detect a tractor trailer in its path because of it. The trailer was white, and so the vehicle crashed right into it, killing the driver. People are very quick to defend the technology and say, well, that was this man's fault for having too much confidence in the technology. But that defense ignores stacks of psychology research that says that human beings evaluate risks on the basis of their experience, and that when the technology starts convincing them that it can do everything, they stop paying attention. So this response is quite predictable. The technology can be wonderful when it helps us humans perform better. But when it sort of lulls us into thinking we don't have to do anything at all, as it often does, then it can actually make the situation more dangerous instead of less.
What about some of the pedestrian deaths that have been caused by driverless cars?
Well, the best known case, the clearest case where it was definitely the vehicle that killed the pedestrian, was a terrible case in 2018 in Tempe, Arizona, suburban Phoenix, really, where Elaine Hertzberg was walking across a road, walking her bike across the road. A vehicle in what Uber called self-driving mode, or actually they called it autonomous mode, was traveling along. It had what they called a safety driver. That is a person whose job it is to sit in the driver's seat and be ready to take over, but otherwise with nothing to do and therefore very bored and distractible. That vehicle was in its autonomous mode. The safety driver was distracted. The vehicle detected Elaine Hertzberg almost 6 seconds before it struck her and never even applied the brakes. Now, some people will say, well, clearly that's just Uber's fault for not programming this vehicle to be more cautious. But what that kind of defense of the technology misses is that there's incredible pressure on these companies to take risks, because this is a very competitive market, and the cautious companies get left behind. In fact, Uber, and this is true for the states, by the way, too. So we have 50 states in this country. And if you have a cautious state, well, then a state next door is going to say, why don't you come do business with us? We'll be less cautious. So Uber originally wanted to try this in California. California said, are you crazy? We don't experiment on our population with your new technology. You can't do that here. So Arizona's governor sent out a tweet. The tweet said, we in Arizona have open minds and open roads. Why don't you come and do business here? And so the standards were lowered, because when you have 50 states, you have a race to the bottom for the least regulation. And Uber, therefore, was under competitive pressure to take chances, and Arizona was ready to let them do that to its own citizens.
So what does it say about California? I mean, is California a more of a model of how we should be approaching autonomous vehicles?
Well, it's a mixed story. On the whole, it's good, I think, though, because what California demonstrated is that, like any state government, there should be a standard that the state government holds companies to. And it should be prepared to say to companies, we do not permit you to take risks with the citizens of our state just for your business opportunities. At the same time, California has been increasingly welcoming of proposals for certain sort of experimental or prototype vehicle operations in San Francisco, for example, where there are some autonomous vehicle companies working on introducing autonomous vehicle services in the city. I can't say that California has been relatively cautious, and I think it should stay that way, because if the interest is in moving people and helping them get to their destinations, we've got much better choices. And so there's no reason for taking risks to help companies develop autonomous vehicles. What they're doing really when that happens is the state is offering its assistance to a private company trying to develop a market for its product.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Kiwi Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Peter Norton, who's written a new book called Autonorama, The Illusory Promise of High-Tech Driving. There's a lot of arguments that are made that people prefer to drive cars than to take public transit. And that's one of the arguments that I've heard made about why the streetcar tracks were torn out of most cities in the United States. I'd heard from some forces that was a conspiracy on the part of the auto industry to undo electrification and the whole idea of mass transit. And then other people who've argued, no, people, the mass transit was not being used. People prefer their cars. So what do you think was true?
Well, I think you've been given a false choice. It doesn't have to be one or the other of those two alternatives. There's no question that people rode streetcars in great numbers and were so generally satisfied with them that millions of urban Americans had no interest in buying a car until they lost that alternative. And when they lost that alternative, that's when they resorted to a car. And often when they finally got it, it was such a relief that, you know, it looked like there was some enthusiasm behind this choice. But that's simply because the alternatives were gone. And when the alternatives to driving are gone, then people do tend to value their car and feel like they really need it, quite understandably, because what other alternative do they have? But the version of history that you'll sometimes hear, that Americans say preferred the car to taking the streetcar, is a distorting, misleading, and gross oversimplification. Because the historically documented fact of the matter is that people were so satisfied with their electric streetcars in American cities that they were refusing to buy automobiles. And we know that that was a source of frustration to the auto companies because they said so themselves in writing in their own trade journals and internal documents. You can see them saying, nobody wants to buy our car because they're riding the streetcar. Now, it's another oversimplification to say, well, then the auto companies just got together and pulled up the railroad tracks and trashed the systems. Because before those rails were pulled up and before the streetcar systems were abandoned, the real victory for car dependency had already been won. By then, the car industries had managed to convince the state governments and the city governments and so on to redefine streets as places for cars, so they would have to have higher speed limits, walking across streets would be strictly controlled and regulated, the engineering standards would favor driving, the laws would favor driving. They even worked on the social norms and the school safety education in ways to normalize and prioritize driving. And all of those successes were achieved before the street railways were pulled up. And those were the really decisive successes. So the later trend where the streetcars were abandoned and pulled up was kind of the last nail in a coffin that had already been made for the street railways.
Well, while I was reading your book, I've been watching this TV show called Dope Sick, which is about the OxyContin epidemic that started out in Appalachia and the horrible mendacity of the Sackler family who owned Purdue Pharma. And I kept thinking that there's a parallel between the way that the Sackler family foisted OxyContin on doctors and on doctors' patients and the way that the auto industry foisted the automobile on our society.
I think that's a very close parallel. In fact, it's one I also made myself in the book, because in both cases, whether it's General Motors and other auto companies as well, or Purdue Pharma, both companies are recognizing that if they can not only sell their product as a useful tool under certain circumstances, but sell it as the ultimate solution to everyone's problems, then they can create a growing market. So in both cases, whether it's OxyContin or other opioids or car dependency, what you're selling is not just the drug or not just the vehicle, but a whole world that depends on this. So they're selling dependency. When you don't have a car and you live in a car-dependent city, which is most of urban America, then you are debilitated in a way that almost compels you to buy a car. And once you have normalized the prescription of opioids, even in cases where they would absolutely not have been prescribed before, then you create a situation where the person has to have more of them or has to at least have as much as they've had before, or they will suffer. And so with car dependency, you know, when you start to do something like, say, add a lane to the highway every time there's congestion, you reinforce the dependency. And it's the same thing with the opioids. And incidentally, cigarettes were sold this way too. The addiction is not a bug, but a feature to the people who want to make money off of this.
Well, you talked about how expensive this autonomous vehicle future would be. How does that distract us from what we could really be doing to have perhaps a car-free, congestion-free, pollution-free, and crash-free future?
There's so much we could be doing that's also so much cheaper. And incidentally, even the autonomous vehicles people are constantly saying, well, we're going to need some better technology and then we can deliver it. which drives me crazy because we don't need better technology to do wonderful things right now. And they're also much cheaper. As the experts say that we investors, public and private sector, have spent about $100 billion trying to develop autonomous vehicles. And that money could have been allocated so much more effectively to other things that are vastly cheaper. Some of these things are really practically free. Take, for example, the fact that in your typical American residential area, it's illegal to open up a small grocery store on the corner because this area is likely to be zoned for single-family residences only. But if a small grocery could be opened up on the corner, first of all, a lot of the residents might absolutely welcome it as a convenience. And secondly, a lot of people could walk or ride a bike or perhaps take a shuttle of some kind or a bus to that grocery store instead of having to get in their car. And people will say, well, when I get groceries, I need a car to carry all the groceries. Well, that's partly because we have adapted to going to the supermarket, say, once or twice a week. But if you had a grocery store that was 3 blocks away, it would not be a big deal to go there more often. So that would not take really any money, and it would actually increase freedom. It ought to be welcomed by conservatives and liberals alike because, presumably conservatives would welcome the relaxation of regulation that would permit that grocery store to open up. So, that's a practically zero cost thing. There's many others like it, simply things that we can do that can make walking practical and not just something we do as a deliberate exercise routine, but as an actual way to do our daily errands like, our parents or grandparents all did. Cycling can be normalized. Yes, only a small fraction of people are willing to cycle now for practical needs, but that's because cycling feels dangerous most of the time. But if we make cycling seem or actually safe, then more people can cycle. And we can use technology to promote that because the electric bike is now a practical thing, and that lets people cycle in hilly places, and it lets people who are less athletically fit cycle practically as well. And transit can be really improved. It's not cheap, but it is vastly cheaper than say adding a lane to a highway every time there's congestion. We have great examples of this worldwide. I think the best one is in the Netherlands, where this has really been developed. It makes for safer roads. Drivers give more positive reviews of driving there as well, because all the people who don't want to drive have other choices, and therefore the roads are occupied only by the people who have chosen to drive. You have electric mobility that doesn't need batteries in the form of electric trains and electric streetcars. It's a really, there are really wonderful things we could do now, and I just wish we could divert most of the money going into autonomous vehicles into those things.
Well, one other issue is climate, and it seems that that's such a pressing issue right now. And the focus on electric vehicles, even though they're better than fossil fuel-powered vehicles, it still seems that we're relying on a very carbon-intensive future.
You're absolutely right. So electric vehicles are necessary. We're going to need them. Battery electric vehicles, battery electric cars and buses and so on are all necessary, and we need them. But we simply can't have them displace or replace all of the combustion engine vehicles, and we simply can't be driving them as much. And sometimes that sounds like a sacrifice to people, but it turns out that, when Americans get a holiday and take it overseas, they tend to all want to go to cities, whether they're in Mexico or Europe or elsewhere, where they can walk, because it's actually very pleasant to be in a town where you can walk to the restaurant, walk to the grocery store, and so on. One of the reasons why Americans go abroad to do that is that we generally can't do that here. But if we could, the cities could be more livable, more attractive, more inviting places to be, and more sustainable. And then the electric vehicles really have a chance to do what they can do best, because they would be supplementing other things instead of trying to be the all-purpose transport necessities that we've gotten used to in the form of cars.
Well, Peter, it's been great talking to you. Thanks for taking us on a tour of Autonorama and the other Futuramas.
It's been a great pleasure.
Thanks for being on Locus Focus.
My pleasure, Barbara.
We've been talking with Peter Norton, author of Autonorama, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of the show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Or please support the community radio station you're listening to right now. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Next week, we'll get an update from Rebecca White with Cascadia Wildlands on the lawsuit to stop clear-cutting in the Willamette National Forest. We'll go out with music by the Beatles. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance when necessary and wear a mask.